House Judiciary Committee on this Monday afternoon. Appreciate your promptness. We're going to start. We're still missing a couple of our members, but we have a quorum, and so we'll begin to work our agenda. I want to just make a brief change in the order on the agenda to accommodate Representative Butler, who is here to testify on House Bill 2332. And so with that, we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2332, and I'd invite Representative Butler and Ann, is it Rupp or Roop? Ann Roop, come forward. If you would come forward, please. And we're ready whenever you are, Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Tom Butler from House District 60 in southeastern Oregon. I'm continuing to wear my beef hat. It's what's for dinner, and this is a beef about how eastern Oregon, and particularly our smaller counties, sometimes get treated as we go through the budget process. We need to remember those great people of southeastern Oregon, and 500,000 cows can't be all wrong. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'm here today to speak to you with regard to House Bill 2332. And coming from eastern Oregon this morning is Ann Roop, and she'll identify who she is and her experiences in the state of Oregon, several generations in the state of Oregon. 2332 allows the Department of Justice to work with private escrow companies to collect and be responsible for the distribution electronically of child support fees and funds. The I think the bill is fairly self-explanatory, and with that, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll let Ann Roop tell you what it is that this does.
Great. Thank you. Welcome.
Representative Williams and members of the Judiciary Committee, thank you very much for hearing me today. I've provided, which should be handed out to you, a little packet. The top is a description of the program or the process that we're proposing in an amendment to ORS 25030 and 25130 as our House Bill 2332. We're proposing that a private entity provide an electronic capture and disbursement of child support payments. Our webware and electronic system would allow the courts to establish a child support payment account at the time the decree is granted so that the families can already have the ability to process the funds right away and to track for them. Our records would be displayed on the internet without identifying any names or individuals or anything personal about the parties, and could only be accessed by a specific number provided to the parties at the time the decree is granted. So we have, I want to be very clear here, is that this program does not utilize any records through the web. It only displays information on the web that is downloaded at one time. We don't do our processing through the web. I should back up and introduce myself. I'm sorry. I got so anxious to tell you about the bill. I am I'm like Tom and the cows. Once we go to eastern Oregon, we don't leave there, and I've been there several generations, primarily in Harney County and Malheur County. My family established their business in 1940. My parents did in Malheur County and eventually in four eastern Oregon counties, title insurance and escrow business. So we have been licensed escrow agent in the state of Oregon since escrow licenses were granted. So I'm very well acquainted with the existing regulatory process, and it's under that process that we've proposed this measure. This measure does not cost the state of Oregon anything. It does not impact any of the regulatory duties other than the fact that it's a very similar audit to what we already experience and much simpler than what you currently would see under the real estate rules. I might mention that I have been a lifelong advocate for Oregon, and that Governor Roberts and Governor Kitzhaber both appointed me to several different commissions like prison industries and sentencing guidelines we used to meet in this room, and transportation initiative to mention a few. I have visited with the Oregon Real Estate Agency about this measure, and they have no objections. The Family Law Council is very supportive. The Oregon Land Title Association is very supportive, which might also just bring to point one of the things that this activity can help both private business and government, and that is, it's very difficult these days unless a family is having their child support payments managed through OCSP, there's no record. There's no easily accessible record. So both lending institutions and title companies are pushed to be the parties that must gain an affidavit from an obligee stating that all child payments are current. And if the obligee and obligor don't really like each other, that's a very difficult thing to accomplish. It takes time. It's very costly. It slows down the process, which allows people to buy homes and handle some of their financing needs. This would be one measure that could quickly address that very efficiently and very cost-effectively. You'll also see that this is totally voluntary. Those families that are currently in the OCSP system are there because the courts have required that they be there. They're either on some form of federal or state assistance, which requires them to be monitored and that their payments be current. And so primarily OCSP not only accounts for all of these, but they provide the strong arm of enforcement. That we have no interest in that part of the processing. We simply want to offer this to families who are not in the OCSP system, are not required by the courts to be in them, and currently have no other way to verify and account for the funds. I think that's all I have. Any questions?
Any questions from the committee? All right. Representative Cuomo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you mentioned that it would not be it would be displayed on the web, but the records would not be kept on the web. So I presume that there's some kind of a server that childpay.com would have that allows for the records to be there. If a person were a paying non-custodial parent is paying, and how can they be assured that the dollars that they've put in are being credited to the correct account?
That's a good question. The way our system works, this will mirror how we currently handle electronic debits and credits in the escrow field. So on any contract, land sale contract or purchase of any kind, we receive the payment as per it is structured. Now, our patented website and webware actually allows anyone, anytime the courts, to come on and customize our account documents. The court can do it. An attorney can do it. They'll identify exactly what is to be done in their instructions to us, how much is to be paid, who pays the fee, things about the children that we need to note as far as them, their ages, and Social Security numbers. All of that is data entered on the ground. It has nothing to do with the web. Our processing system and all of our data is kept in a separate system completely. And the only way the payment history actually is passed on to the Internet or the web is what we call it dumps a data stream into a bucket, totally separate. They're not co-joined in any way, but the processing system sends a little stream of information into a separate bucket, which is then grabbed by the web and pulled up and displayed as a picture. There's nothing that interacts in any way, shape, or form. It's kind of a PDF document. We don't use any names, addresses, or Social Security numbers on the web. So the individual who looks at those records could have obtained them only by having a very unusual and computer-generated password that is assigned at the time the account is opened. And it can only be provided to others by the parties who have them or by direction in writing to us. So if a lender, let's say that an obligor wants to refinance their home and a lender wants to know if their child support payments are current, the obligor can direct us to contact the lender and provide them with a printout of their statement, or they can give their password to the lender if they so choose.
Which would be really stupid, I would add.
Well, there's really no way. In fact, in the packet I've passed out, we have prepared a sample web homepage and sample payment history, and you can access it by accessing our web address, www.childpay.com, and you simply type in, select records on the drop-down menu, go in and you'll see a menu will tell you to type in Demo 1, and it'll show you what the payment history looks like, and unless you know it's yours and that's the payment you're supposed to pay, it doesn't mean really much of anything. So we would use the records on the ground and in processing to help verify that that record belongs to them, but there really be no way anyone would know whose it is.
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, if I might just add that I think the Department of Justice feels like that they'll have the capacity to do something similar to this by the end of this next biennium, general funds permitting. My concern is that most all of the IT projects, which the various agencies are coming forward with right now, are on a master wish list and may or may not be funded.
Right.
And so what Ms. Roop's company has done is that they have gone ahead and developed the childpay.com, which I understand may be available in other states as well, but it is accessed by a unique number, and then it only comes up. I went into the demo before I came down, and it only comes up with just a number, just an account number. There's no names, addresses, or anything else. That way the obligor and the obligee can make certain that their monthly obligations are being transferred in and then paid back out to the necessary parties. That way also it creates a record so that if they then were in the process of a refinance of their residence or obtaining other financing, then the title company can come forward and give a statement basically warranting that payment has been made by the obligor to the obligee. So it speeds up that process as well.
We're well practiced in confidentiality.
I guess if I may, Mr.
You
Chair,
may.
I guess the only thing that I'm concerned about is from a standpoint of security, because as we found out yet again over the weekend, another 8 million or so credit cards have become bait for the hacker gangs that are out there. And what I want to make sure of is that there is sufficient security. And I'm a little bit more at ease with the fact that you have mentioned that the two systems aren't really connected.
In fact, there's three systems, I might tell you. The third system that's absolutely not connected is the banking electronic system, ACH system, and we're very versed in using it, and it is a totally separate system. So what we really have are files we set up initially with these families, and once we set them up, they are sent into the bank. I mean, we don't play with them. We don't touch them. They're not connected to our database where we process data. So there's just really no connection. There's no way anyone can get in. We don't handle credit issues either. My biggest concern, frankly, was what we do as a licensed escrow agent. Any NSF someone provides to me, I have to cover immediately because we process the funds within 72 to 96 hours, and we most of the time have no idea who it is that gave us the bad check. So I was very concerned. In this case, I would think my percentages of maybe nebulous funds might be far greater. So what you'll see in here is that we will require one payment in trust. So if I get an electronic bounce, if I have a payment kickback, I'll reach into the trust, I'll cover the payment, the kids get their money, the obligor has 20 days to step up and cover everything, or I'm going to report them. And I think for DOJ and for the system of effectively seeing these kids covered and the money flowing well, it's a very smooth and very simple system. There's really nothing complex here except we are using the web, and it's just like so many applications on the web, it is for information purposes, not for processing.
Okay. Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
Are you currently providing this service to any other states?
No.
Okay.
No.
Are you planning to?
Yes. Idaho is looking at us. Of course, both states are very similar in some of the regulations, and so it would be a potential there. Some of the states decided a long time ago that if the federal government was going to really have such a tight control on child support payments and enforcement, that all people would have to go through a state agency. Oregon, the way ORS 25030 is written, there's just a place that there could be another election, and we're hoping that this can provide some ease.
Sure. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, I think the state of New Mexico may have some legislation already similar to allow title companies to do this.
Well, I might add on that, Tom, that New Mexico is the only state that I'm aware of that actually has an interactive site for child support accounts to be established. Last I saw, it's $250 to set up one account. It's about 8 pages of data they want the parties to complete. From our perspective, we'd rather pull the data from the courts or the attorney. Number one, I'm not an attorney, so I don't want to get in the business of preparing or filling out legal documents. And secondly, we've estimated that we can set up these accounts for $10 and charge the parties $4.25 a month, which means an obligor will pay about $51 a year for accounting for their child support payments, and I think that's very affordable. And the reason we can do it is because we're not handling paper. If I have to handle checks, there's no way I could do it this way. But we can set it up electronically and do it affordably. In the long run, I can envision that it can definitely reduce the cost of the labor and the expenses related not only to refinancing but also to enforcement, because the quicker these families get in the system if they're going to have problems, the less baggage they drag in, like thousands of dollars in arrearage. So we can get this early on. And for the families who don't ever want to go there, they've started out right to begin with. And I actually think if an obligor gets used to the money being gone from their account, they'll get used to it a lot faster than if they control it longer. So, and that's just coming from personal experience, not from anything else.
Representative Crummell.
Well, it brings up one other question, because I just noticed the cost here. So, person says, yes, I want to do this, $10, and then $425. So if their monthly obligation is $250, for example, the amount deducted from their checking account is going to be $254.25.
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Exactly.
Why don't we, if there aren't any other questions by committee members, let's bring up Ronelle Schenkel from the Department of Justice. Okay. Hey, you go ahead and, yeah, you, well, we've got that other seat, too. If you want to stay, you can, Representative.
Good afternoon. For the record, Ronelle Schenkel with the Department of Justice Division of Child Support. And you are being handed my written testimony related to this bill. And in there you'll see that the department is neutral, only because this is not a federal mandate, surprise, surprise, and isn't something that we brought forward. But I wanted to come to the table today with Representative Butler and Ms. Roop to let you know, first of all, that Representative Butler himself has met several times with me to ensure that this proposal will fit within our federal regulations and our statutory scheme for the child support program. And Ms. Roop herself drove across the state to meet with us and talk about how this would work from the perspective of the escrow agents themselves. So you see in my written testimony, and I will not go over it unless you wish me to do so, on the first page you have our federal sites that do in fact say that child support payments will be collected by income withholding unless the court grants an exception, and that payments will go through the statewide disbursement unit, which in Oregon is the Department of Justice. On the second page, you'll see the Chapter 25 references that more specifically allow for those actions. Basically, this bill proposes a new private and public enterprise, so to speak, where there would be another option and an exception to income withholding and direct payment to bank accounts, where the parties could agree to have this furnished by an escrow agent, and it would go through that process rather than through the program for services. We do, as mentioned earlier, provide services to families in Oregon, sometimes only those accounting services. However, as mentioned, we do not have staff available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, to assist when property transactions are going on or parties simply need information on their account. So this would be an added benefit to those families, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Further questions for Ms. Schenkel?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there any mechanism, Ms. Schenkel, in the support enforcement process now that involves a third party? Because, I mean, the function of an escrow is to have somebody who's unconnected from either the paying party or the receiving party, and as a third-party holder of the assets. Is this introducing something that doesn't exist now into the support enforcement process?
Chair Williams and Representative McPherson, this, if I understand your question correctly, yes, this would be new. To date, the child support program, all of the accounting, the receiving and distribution of child support is done actually by the Department of Justice, and that is not an area that we have ever, for example, contracted out.
Okay. Follow up if I may?
Yes, you may.
And is there experience with there being difficulties in support enforcement in effect the settlement of amounts? That is, you mean the function of an escrow in a real estate setting is that, or other uses, but particularly in real estate, is that when you're trying to get, you know, documents together so that you make sure that each party has performed its obligations in a document-intensive environment so that funds are assured of being in hand and then they can be released when those conditions are met. Is there an element of that going on in support enforcement where you need to you don't want to let go of funds until you know that, and Ms. Roop might be appropriate to put the question to her as well. I'm trying to figure out if the escrow aspect of this is adding something that the support enforcement administrative process needs.
Chair Williams and Representative McPherson, yes and no. The program currently, if we are the record keeper, whether or not we're providing full services or just pure accounting where the payments are flowing through us and nothing else, when we are the record keeper, we do have within the program a title and escrow assistance desk that is manned by the Department of Justice, and exactly for the types of issues that you are raising, such as someone needs to have a partial or a full satisfaction, someone needs to know an account balance for a property transaction, somebody needs a subordination, we provide that service. But again, it's not online. It's something where you have to contact a worker. I believe in this scenario, you would be taking those cases that today, due to lack of options, come into the child support program and do nothing more, quite honestly, than sit in our automated system and let money flow through, but they don't get any program staff work. Those instead, those folks would have an option, such as Ms. Roop's company, to not only get that service, but have the additional escrow information provided, and then I'll let her speak to what her particular company would do.
Representative McPherson, what I was hearing was the packaging that occurs when an escrow closing function happens. Our company doesn't provide closing work. We strictly service the closed transaction, which in this case would be the divorce decree and the agreement for how funds were to be dispersed to families amongst members. So again, we're still disinterested, but what we're doing is taking directions through our instructions. There are written instructions that they tell us that we are to collect from the obligor $254.25, take our fee, and pay the balance into the obligee's account. That's about as sophisticated as our instructions are. If there is a need to verify the accuracy of the records so that they can do financing or there's some sort of relief, we're very familiar with that and would support that if it's a part of the instructions to us. But we're really looking at this strictly as another way that child support funds can be processed outside the enforcement arena. Out of 16,000 divorces in the state of Oregon 2 years ago, 8,000 involved children. The other 8,000 didn't. A large percentage of them could have involved alimony, some form of family support issues that didn't involve children. And that probably a large percentage also are not on government assistance. Those are the families we're interested in. They're not involved in OCSP, except for the small number they have that have kind of arrived there because there was no other choice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, thank you, Representative McPherson. Council.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ms. Schenkel, the way I read this bill, this does not apply to situations where you are the obligee. Is that correct?
Chair Williams and Council Taylor, that is correct. If there is an assignment of support to the state, they would not be able to offer this option to that family at the time.
Follow-up questions,
yes.
To members of the committee. So that means that it's basically situations where there's been a support order issued by the court and parties are current and there is no state involvement?
Chair Williams and Council Taylor, I believe the anticipation is this would most likely be those customers that are entering a divorce decree in circuit court, and at that point, when the court and the parties are currently looking at their only option being payment through a bank account, they would have this as yet an additional option. You're correct. Once they're in our system and receiving our services, those are not the types of cases that the escrow agents would be taking on, since we either are providing full services or already have established the record.
Chair, members of the committee, if I could say, the way I read the bill, all this deals with is the fact that someone will get escrow agent will get an electronic transfer. Is that correct? I mean, there's no other issues that I see in the bill.
No, there are no other issues. It's just a matter of processing a payment.
Okay, are there any further questions? Hearing none, thank you all very much. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2332. We'll open a work session on House Bill 2332.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Crummell.
I would move House Bill 2332 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Crummell moves House Bill 2332 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, why don't you call the roll, Ann?
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Crummell?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative
Bozanski?
Aye.
Representative
Shetterly? Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Aye. House Bill 2332 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Crummell, would you carry it?
Sure.
Thank you very much.
Glad to.
Well, we could invite a non-committee member. It's not typically our practice, but Representative Butler, would you like the pleasure of carrying the bill?
Mr. Chair, I'll be happy to support Representative Crummell as he carries that bill and offer any assistance I may.
So let it be written.
Thank you.
All right. Okay, moving back to our order of it. You almost got out of it, Jerry. That was pretty slick. We're going to go to House Bill 2034. And I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2034. And I would like to call up, if I could, Craig Durbin, Rob Bovitt, and Larry Welty.
Asking questions, apparently. Mr. Chair, representatives, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Rob Bovitt, Assistant County Counsel, Lincoln County. And I am glad I came both high-tech and low-tech because I can see that my computer, after sitting here, is kind of frozen up. So I'm going to revert to low-tech and just kind of collapse that. And I'll be talking directly off of the handout I've just given to you. Get a copy here. I'd like to call your attention to this handout when you get it, which is basically just a printout of the slideshow that I had going here. I'd like to briefly discuss with you some of the statistics from last year, meth labs in Oregon in particular. The first few slides of this presentation just show you a few clippings that I've clipped out of our local paper, the News Times and the News Guard. Now, I could have done this from any community, but I'm from Lincoln County, and so I just clipped them out of our paper. And I won't spend a whole lot of time because I recognize a lot of the faces here from 2001, and you guys all know about the extreme dangers from meth labs, the toxic chemicals that are used in making methamphetamine, the portability, the recent portability, we call them box labs in the industry of meth labs that we're encountering throughout Oregon. And the most recent problem that we've been tackling, especially in rural areas of Oregon, which is the chemical waste, the dump sites that we've been running into, which can toxify our water supplies, which can threaten those that are out in the woods, and cost quite a bit of money to clean up. Also briefly mention the violent and property crimes that are commonly associated with meth labs and meth cleanups, and I just have a couple clippings there as well, again, from our local papers. But what I'm really here to talk to you about is the stats here before I talk to you about House Bill 2034. On page 4 of the handout, you'll notice that we have 508 reported Oregon meth labs in 2002. On the next page, you'll see how those break down. Of those 508 reported meth labs, 9 exploded, 10 were super labs, and I'll talk about super labs here in just a minute. And you can see the breakdown in terms of the counties, 5 in Marion, 1 in Lynn, 1 in Clackamas, 1 in Coos, 1 in Tillamook, and 1 in Washington County.
At those 508 labs, there were 108 children rescued, 50 of whom were chemically exposed. You can see the breakdown in the statistics in terms of the age bracket of the children that were in these meth lab sites. You'll notice that by far the mass majority were small young children. There were also two children last year injured in an exploded meth lab, and they were ages 9 and 10. And you can see the weapons that were seized out of these meth lab sites as well, quite a variety of pretty dangerous stuff. We've also seen a slow trend shifting from having meth labs only in the rural areas to now more in the suburban areas. And I think that's just a feature of how these meth labs are becoming smaller and more portable. There's no reason why you have to go way out into the woods to cook meth anymore. In terms of the top 10 counties, I'm glad to say that Lincoln County is number 10 because last year we were number 9. It's not quite an improvement. I think what happened is a bunch of other counties moved up. However, if you look at the statistics, by population, I think we hold our own with just about anybody, and it's quite a problem in my county as it is in many counties, and you can see some of the statistics for the counties that were most impacted. And again, keep in mind, these numbers, this 508 reported meth labs that we're talking about here, this is just a tip of the iceberg. Law enforcement is not pretending that we're finding and taking down the majority of meth labs in the state of Oregon. This is just the ones that are being located. If you want to compare Oregon with the rest of the nation, on page 6, here's how we ranked. We ranked 9th in the nation for meth labs, total meth labs reported in 2002. We ranked 4th in the nation for super labs, and again, I'll talk about super labs in just a moment. And we ranked 8th in the nation for the number of children rescued at meth labs in 2002. We're quite on the forefront of this. You've all heard about meth before. I'm not going to spend any time talking about that. I do have some pictures of methamphetamine and crystal meth and ice and how it's typically sold on the street these days. And I won't spend any time talking about meth addiction because, again, this is quite an educated crowd, and I don't need to tell you about the horrors of methamphetamine and how difficult an addiction cycle this particular one is to break. Mostly here to talk about meth labs. And on the next few slides, I've got some basic information about the three generations of meth labs that we're dealing with these days. In order to understand these three generations of meth labs, I think you need to understand one basic thing about methamphetamine, and that is that there's two varieties. Now, the scientists call them isomers. I don't know what that means. I just know that there's two varieties of meth. The first variety of methamphetamine is what they call L-methamphetamine. This is an example of L-methamphetamine, a Vicks vapor inhaler. This is methamphetamine. It's just the L variety. It doesn't get you high, cleans out your lungs, cleans out your sinuses. You all know what Vicks inhaler does. The good stuff, at least the good stuff to the addict, is the D-meth. And really, there's kind of a third variety, and that's just what we call DL-meth. So you got a little bit of the L and you got a little bit of the D. And you'll see how this comes to play when we talk about meth labs here. On page 8 of my handout here, and I'll just quickly go through this here. First generation of meth labs that we first started running into in the late 60s all the way up to the present, although I can tell you I haven't seen one of these meth labs in Lincoln County since 1992. We just don't run into these meth labs anymore, these first generation meth labs, and you'll see why here in a minute. They're commonly known on the streets as P2P labs. That's what the cops call them. There's a variety of ways to do these labs, but the one common ingredient that you get to before you get to meth is something called phenyl-2-propanone. So the cops just call it P2P labs. These labs would feature chemistry equipment, so you'd have test tubes, beakers, flasks, you know, complex stuff that gave you nightmares when you were in high school chemistry class. Complicated formulas. I've tried, and I'm not good with science anyways. I've tried, but I really can't understand what's going on in these first-generation meth labs. You really need a science background to really understand it. Relatively hard to find chemicals, not stuff that I can go down to Walmart and Freddy's and pick up. And I guess importantly, these first-generation meth labs, they produced a relatively impure DL meth, and that's even when they did it right. So they were producing the speed, the crank, the poor man's cocaine of the 70s and the 80s. Back then used to be associated with biker gangs. Didn't know this until a couple years ago that methamphetamine got its nickname crank, not because it cranks you up, which is what it does, but because the bikers would traffic it in the crank cases of their Harley-Davidsons. Hence, you got your name crank. From about the mid-80s to the present, we've been running into what is commonly known, at least the cops commonly refer to, as a red P lab. This is still technically the most common type, although the trend is shifting towards the third generation I'll talk about in a minute. Again, there's a variety of ways to do these labs, cold cook, hot cook methods, a variety of ways I won't get into right now, but the one common ingredient that all these labs have is something known as red phosphorus. That's one of those regulated substances that you dealt with in 2001 I'll talk about here in a minute. But unlike first generation meth labs, these meth labs is common household equipment, stuff that you all have in your kitchen. Really simple formulas, basic. Even I can understand what's going on in one of these meth labs. Easy to find chemicals, stuff that I can pick up down at Walmart, Freddy's, what have you. And if they do it right, and if they don't catch fire and blow themselves up, and they actually do it right, they can produce a relatively pure D-meth. Using these meth labs, they can produce the good stuff. These types of labs are commonly associated with both your local user dealers, in other words, your mom and pop cooking on the kitchen stove, all the way up to your major drug trafficking organizations, because Red P labs, second generation labs, are scalable. Using one of these labs, I can make an ounce at a time, or I can make 10 pounds at a time. It's just a matter of scale. On the next page, I got a couple of quick pictures of what we call super labs. These are Red P labs. Super labs are defined as labs that are capable of generating 10 pounds or more of meth at a time. Now, last year, we took down 10 meth labs in the state of Oregon. They used to only be found in very remote areas of Central California because these are big labs and you had to kind of keep them hidden. But California did such a darn good job at chasing them out of California. Guess where they went to? You got it, Oregon, Washington. So we're seeing numbers start to show up here. Each of these flasks, for your information, you're seeing on those pictures there, can generate about 10 pounds of pure meth at a time. So over the course of a weekend, one of these super labs can generate about 100 pounds of meth. Again, we took them down. My client helped take one down in Tillamook County last year, a number of in Marion County and in other parts of Oregon as well. Gets even better. In the mid-90s, some first-generation meth cooks rediscovered some things the Nazis were playing around with back in the late 1930s, rediscovered some old patents that they had taken out, and started another trend for meth labs, and we call them third-generation meth labs, or cops call them Nazi labs for short, because these trace back to the Germans playing around with meth in the late 30s. Like second-generation stuff, common household equipment, stuff you all got in your kitchen, really simple formulas, basic common household chemicals that you can pick up at Freddy's. And again, like second generation, it can produce nearly pure D-methamphetamine, commonly associated usually with only with local user dealers. If you tried to make more than an ounce or two using a Nazi method, you'd probably blow yourself up. The reactions are just too difficult to contain. Meth lab chemicals, and I'll just talk about this really briefly, and then talk about the bill that you got in front of you here today. I have a handout, or actually attached to my testimony, accompanying the handout. On the third page, you'll see listed. I've just listed out on the left-hand side some of the common chemicals used to cook methamphetamine. Now, you don't need all these chemicals. This is just an alphabetical list of all the chemicals typically used in either a second or a third generation meth lab. And for your information, I've just put a display that I've been carrying around for the last year or so. I call it my bag of goodies. Off to the right here, actually off to my left here on the table, some of the common chemicals used to cook methamphetamine that I purchased for about $50 at one of our local stores one evening. Doesn't take a whole lot of money, doesn't take a whole lot of resources to do one of these meth labs. Extremely toxic, extremely dangerous, but not very costly. Now, I will tell you that at least in Lincoln County, it's not true in all counties, but at least in Lincoln County, if I tried to do what I did about a year ago today in the same store, not only would they not sell it to me, but they'd probably send me a nice video of myself along with pictures of my license plate number and the rest. We took down 4 meth labs last year as a direct result of retailer-supplied information in Lincoln County. Very helpful. Very proud of the retailers in Lincoln County. On the next slide is just a comparison of the base ingredient, and this is the prime ingredient that I'm going to be talking about here in a minute, ephedrine or pseudoephedrine and methamphetamine, and I've just compared the molecular structures on the left and the right. And again, I'm not a scientist, don't pretend to understand this stuff, but as I understand it from the scientists I talk to, the only difference is one oxygen atom. They go through all this nonsense and madness and chemical chaos, basically, to create methamphetamine, just eliminating that one oxygen atom from ephedrine to get to methamphetamine. Some of the extreme dangers that, again, I'm not going to spend much time here because this is an educated crowd. Exposure to toxic and corrosive chemicals is one of the prime dangers. You may have noticed in some of the earlier slides I had here that our guys that take down meth labs, they wear self-contained breathing apparatus. There's a reason for that. Some of the gases that can be created at these meth labs are pretty scary stuff. One of the primary ones is phosphine gas. This can kill you rapidly in as little as 500 parts per million. Our guys even wear a phosphine badge on the outside of their SCBA suits because the SCBA suits are insufficient necessarily to safe keep them from phosphine gas. And even scarier gas, and thankfully it's not generated very often, is phosgene gas. Phosgene gas is actually a weapon of war. We're concerned that Saddam Hussein has phosgene gas. I'm more concerned about meth cooks generating it in these meth labs on the stove. Fire and explosion is a common problem with meth labs. You see that little clipping I have from a tent that exploded in South Beach State Park in my hometown here last year. This was a real genius of a meth cook that was cooking meth at 3 a.m. In the middle of the night in a tent in South Beach State Park. And guess what? His lantern ran out of batteries. So guess what this guy did? He got out a Bic lighter. Poof, whole thing went up. They had to lifelight him over to Emanuel Hospital. Meth lab waste and dump sites I'll talk about just real briefly. For every pound of methamphetamine cooked, there's 5 to 6 pounds of toxic waste that has to go somewhere. Some of it's disposed of on site, hence the large cost for cleaning up these dump sites. But a lot of it's just dumped out in our forest, and we found quite a number of meth lab dump sites in the Siuslaw Forest last year, and the trend is continuing upward. And they're very dangerous and hazardous. For example, the barrel on the bottom left there you see is still actively generating phosphine gases that sits out there in the field. So I worry about hunters. I worry about, you know, foresters, people that are out in the woods. And then finally, the last slide. I'll just briefly catch you up to how we got here today. Meth lab precursor legislation. We hadn't updated our precursor legislation in Oregon from 1987 to 2001. As a result of not updating, we missed two generations of meth labs, and Oregon regrettably became a destination location for meth cooks because we were so far behind. We caught up dramatically in 2001 with House Bill 3661, which was brought to you by ONEA and the state police. That updated Oregon law kept us at a par with a lot of our sister states and actually took us one step further in a couple of aspects. But primarily it regulated some of the key ingredients, such as ephedrine, iodine, red phosphorus, and the containers used to house anhydrous ammonia. Which brings us up to where we're at here with House Bill 2034. Attached to my testimony, and I won't go through it because I've already probably rattled on here too long, but at the last two pages of my testimony, I've provided you a section-by-section explanation of what's going on in House Bill 2034 and the Dash 2 amendments. And I guess before I forget, we also have Dash 3 amendments, which I worked with the Veterinary Medical Association to put together. We also support those as well, although I didn't have those at the time that I drafted this. We're supportive of those as well. If you have any specific questions about House Bill 2034, I'm happy to answer them. But in general, they do two things. House Bill 2034 fixes a few technical glitches in House Bill 3661 that I promised in 2001 I would come back to you and ask you to fix. It fixes technical matters relating to iodine, something called methyl sulfonyl methane, MSM, which is a precursor cutting agent. It conforms certain regulations that we put in place to the real world, and I don't think you're going to be hearing any testimony opposed to any of those changes today, and so I won't spend a whole lot of time going through them. What I think you may hear some testimony about in terms of opposition to at least a part of this bill is what we're proposing to do with ephedrine or pseudoephedrine. Pseudoephedrine, all those products I got back there are mix and match products. If you bar me from having one, I can swap in another. With a few exceptions over there, all of them can be switched and swapped over. The one exception to all that for both second and third generation meth labs is pseudoephedrine. You know it better as Actifed, Sudafed, the generic equivalents. This is the one key base ingredient that they have to have. The more of this they have, the more meth they can make. What we're proposing to do, what we did in House Bill 3661 in 2001, was regulate how many of these you could possess or buy at a time. What's happened since that time is what I call, or actually what a lot of folks call, smurfing, where you'll have your meth cooks, or there's actually people out there that will do nothing but obtain a lot of this stuff for meth cooks by going to various stores serially, sometimes involving children, to do the smurfing for them. I could explain to you, I will explain to you just briefly here. What we're proposing here in House Bill 2034 originally was to prohibit sales to minors. Now, the industry screamed at us about that. They didn't want us imposing another cigarette alcohol-type regulating scheme relating to this. I understand that. I heard them. So what I did was I looked at the trends in other states. What are other states recently doing in relation to ephedrine and pseudoephedrine? And the recent trend seems to be to require it simply be placed behind the counter. Now, I can tell you in Lincoln County, at a lot of our stores, you can't buy this stuff over the counter right now as it is. And that's not because of House Bill 3661. That's because so much of this stuff is getting ripped off by the meth cooks that, as a matter of self-protection, many of the retailers have placed it behind the counter. But that doesn't level the playing field. What that does is it creates an unlevel playing field between the retailers of putting it behind the counter and the retailers that can keep it out in front. The ones that can keep it out in front are generally the places where the meth cook, the smurfer, is going to get it. I have a quote here that we recently got, and I could explain to you why I think this is probably the key provision in House Bill 2034 and the dash two amendments. But on the last page of my testimony, a couple weeks ago, one of these smurfers, recently convicted smurfers under House Bill 3661, made a statement to his, a written statement to his probation officer, and I would encourage you to read that bolded statement because I can't explain it any better than that. Placing pseudoephedrine behind the counter will not infringe upon me or anyone else who wants to buy this stuff for my allergies. I bought some of this the other day. I went to J.C. Market across from the courthouse and got some of this for my daughter. And as I was doing my shopping, I just went by their courtesy counter and asked for one of these boxes. It's not going to infringe on my ability to get this stuff at all. What it will do is it will put a real big roadblock to the smurfer, the guy who wants to come in and buy a whole bunch of it, or repeatedly or serially buy a whole bunch of it. It's going to put that roadblock and keep Oregon a very unfriendly place to cook methamphetamine. And that has become, over the past few weeks, actually a few months, a very important thing to do for a couple of reasons. One, we can only tune up our precursor legislation once every 2 years. I can only come back to you once every 2 years to fix this stuff. So we got to stay ahead of the curve. Second is, for a variety of reasons, we're losing narcotics task forces throughout the state of Oregon. Our own county, Lint, is down to a core of two detectives. We used to have six, and at the end of the week, we'll have zero. So Lint will cease operations next week, as will many other narcotics task forces throughout the state of Oregon. I can say that publicly. I don't think these guys can say that publicly, but I can say that publicly because I think it's important for people to understand that we've got to keep ahead of this. In Lincoln County, we've taken a very proactive stance and gone out and talked to our retailers, talked to anybody who will listen about monitoring these precursor chemicals voluntarily and trying to get a handle on it. So that's what House Bill 2034 is about. It's about primarily fixing House Bill 3661 and then taking us to the next level to protect us for the next 2 years. And with that, I'll be quiet and be happy to answer any questions or actually turn it over to Larry Welty.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Bovet. Either Mr. Durbin or Welty, whichever one wants to move forward.
Thank you. Chair Williams, members of the committee, my name is Larry Welty. I'm the president of the Oregon Narcotics Enforcement Association. I'm here today to support House Bill 2034. As you've heard from Rob, last session, House Bill 3661 addressed some of the precursor issues related to chemicals, not only to manufacture methamphetamine, but other controlled substances such as GHB. This bill, I believe, will further improve those controls, and in particular in two situations, and I only wanted to focus on two situations today, and that was, number one, iodine. Iodine is one of the major precursors used in the red pea or red phosphorus method. And as a glitch last session, if you want to call it that, somehow we wanted to inspect the records of sales of not only MSM but iodine. And unfortunately, the only thing we can do by statute right now is inspect the records of MSM. If, for instance, a retailer does not want to allow us to inspect the records of iodine that they're required to keep, we can't do that right now. So I feel it's important that we are able as law enforcement to not only inspect the records of sales of MSM, but of iodine. The other issue with iodine was lowering the percentage from, actually raising the percentage from 1.5% up to, I think the amendment reads now, 2%. That was a trade-off with retailers and in the pharmacy. I talked to a chemist with the DEA who is one of their lead chemists to find out just exactly what percentage of iodine it would take to manufacture methamphetamine efficiently. And for the most part, they use 7%. And what I was in question of was the 3.7, which is used as utter wash by the dairy industry. And so I'd asked the chemist, and he said they could still produce it, but it would take them a lot longer to do so. So we felt that by allowing the limit to go up to 3%, 3.7%, that it would take some of the burden off the dairy industry, and we wouldn't have a problem. Well, in the meantime, we started seeing some of this lower percentage iodine showing up at these meth lab sites. So we're asking for the 2% still, because that is included in betadine solutions and is sold to assist in cleaning and sterilizing equipment used by, say, elderly folks and stuff, and in hospitals and so on and so forth. So we're relatively comfortable with the 2%. The other issue was the pseudoephedrine. And I have attached also that same email that was sent by Melinda Rausch, who is the probation officer in Lane County. And we've known for some time that this is an issue, not only with, as an example, somebody can go in a self-serve situation, and you can, in a large store, you can pick any number of registers to go through. So hypothetically, you could get your two or three boxes, you could go through one register, you could turn around, go out the door, come back through the door, get two or three more boxes, and go through another register. But if it's kept behind the counter and you have basically one person that's going to be in charge of that, if they repeatedly see the same face, you know, during the day, they're going to recognize that here, this is a problem situation. And so it would further curtail that. And secondly is the theft issue. I can't tell you what, prior to retiring, I was the commander of the Drug Enforcement Section for the Oregon State Police. I retired last November. I had received the effective date of the 3631 till the time I retired, a number of phone calls from retailers that were having problems with the issue of the theft. And a number of them, like Rob was saying, have voluntarily put it behind the counter because of the loss of the product and the expense associated with that. So with that, I will conclude my testimony, and I'd also be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Welty. Mr. Durbin.
Chair Williams and members of the committee, my name is Craig Durbin. I am a sergeant with Oregon State Police and the manager of the Drug Enforcement Section, and I am here today in support of House Bill 2034. Much of the information in my testimony has already been covered, so I won't go into that. But what I would like to cover is that the chemical statute that was amended last legislative session has had many success stories, and I'd like to just cover a couple of those. We've noticed decreased ability for these cooks to obtain the chemicals that are needed for their labs. We've had documented proof from numerous task forces, and recently a task force member told us that one of these persons that was attempting to smurf chemicals was having to attempt to go to Washington State now in order to obtain those chemicals. And their statement said that basically that law enforcement was making it very difficult for them to obtain the chemicals for their cook. We also know that some of these cooks now are using the Internet and the mail couriers to obtain chemicals from foreign sources because of the difficulty, again, in Oregon, because we've had success with placing clamps down on the chemicals. Retailers are also becoming aware of chemicals to use to make methamphetamine and how those chemicals play a role in the meth process. Because of their awareness, as Rob's already testified, that now they make attempts to do what they can to help law enforcement out, either by giving information or making it even putting more restrictions within their own retail establishment on the chemicals that they're selling. And because of the information that they've gave, we've had numerous cases where law enforcement has been able to find labs. There's been significant seizures of both chemicals, lab finished product, and weapons. As I mentioned before, there's more parts in my testimony, but I won't cover those at this time, and so this concludes my testimony.
Thank you, Officer Durbin. Are there questions for any of this panel? Let's start with Representative Przanski, then Representative Barker, then Representative Shetterly, then Representative Crummel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make sure I'm following. Rob, you made some statements as to not being able to stay up on top of the new precursors. Doesn't on page 2 of the bill, line 25, actually give the authority for precursors by rule to be identified? I'm just wondering why we're stuck if we need to make sure.
Oh, are you talking about, Mr. Chair, Representative Przanski, you're talking about the state police's administrative ability to adjust certain things under state rule.
Right.
Yes, I think they have certain authority to do that, and they can within the limitations of that statute. But largely what we're talking about when we come back to you every 2 years is fixing fundamental things that the state police can't expand upon. Like they can, in theory, add certain things to the list. We're not talking about adding anything to the list. We're talking about how that particular thing is regulated, whether it can be, for example, pseudoephedrine, whether it must be placed behind the counter versus out front. The definition in the statute, for example, for iodine, that's in the statute rather than in the rule. It defines it currently as iodine matrix as 1.5. We're proposing an original bill to 3.7, but now based on recent meth lab experiences, we want to make it 2.0. So some of those things can't only be fixed in statute.
I understand that, but I want to make sure the record's straight, because the way I read that section, it says any substance established as a precursor substance by rule under the authority granted under 475.945, that seems like hopefully the state police can, in fact, be able to identify some substance, whatever that substance is, as a precursor. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Przanski, that is correct. If we got a fourth generation meth lab, God forbid, I think we, depending on how they did it and how they structured it and what chemicals they actually were, we might be able to do something to head that off, depending.
Okay. If I could, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
And I'm not sure, Craig or Larry, which one of this, I think it was Craig had talked, or no, I think it was Larry regarding the percentage on the iodine, dropping it from what was proposed originally, 3.7 down to the 2. Is there any, have you had any discussions with anyone outside of the DEA as to whether that application or that percentage is going to be too low of a percentage, knowing that it used to be 1.5, and I guess the original bill was asking for it to be raised to 3.7. I just want to make sure we're not catching on someone's other legitimate use of iodine that would be greater than 2.7 but less than 2.0 versus 3.7.
Chair Williams and Representative Przanski, I only actually asked the question, and again, I haven't talked to anybody else because Roger Ely is considered to be the foremost expert on the manufacture of methamphetamine as far as chemists go in the laboratories. I did talk to him about the 3.7, and I didn't go actually any lower than that. And as you go lower, the likelihood is gets more remote the further you get away from the 3.7 as you go lower down. And the reason that that we had settled on the 2% again is because I knew that was used by the hospitals and so on and so forth as a sterilizing agent. So I wanted to basically assist pharmacies and so on and so forth with being allowed to sell that without any restrictions, because we weren't seeing anything that low out in the field.
Okay, so just for clarification, for the hospital's use, they are using a 2% or are they using like a 1.9%? I just want to make sure that threshold is not going to catch them up.
It's my understanding that they use a 2%, so the restriction would be anything over 2% is what we would be looking at.
Okay. And the other part, Larry, you mentioned about not being able to look at the records on iodine. And I, again, looking at the section number 1 where it has iodine matrix, it's on page 2, line 21, and also line 20, iodine in its elemental form. I'm wondering why you're being prohibited from making those inquiries and getting their assistance with the, under the current statute.
Mr. Chair, Representative Przanski, maybe I could try to address that. In House Bill 3661, if you go to page 3 of the bill, you'll see subsection 4 in section 2 of the bill on lines 9 to 11. And what we did in part in House Bill 3661 is regulated a couple of the substances just by requiring that records be kept. Iodine is an example. MSM is another example. So what you have here in subsection 4 just relates to MSM. And so it doesn't cover the iodine piece of that. If there were other statutes that came along later that we wanted to add to the precursor chemical statutes, you just wanted to do minimal regulation by record keeping, you'd want to have at least the ability to inspect those records.
All right. Last question, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Regarding the dash twos, it's my reading of that is that it would not prohibit under the with the dash twos a miner being able to go in and purchase whatever quantity they may limit voluntarily of Sudafed or whatever type of cold cough medicine or whatever may have those substances?
Mr. Chair, Representative Przanski, our original proposal was to essentially prohibit minors from purchasing any quantity of Sudafed. And right now you can only purchase 9 grams. That's anybody, minors or adults. And we were just going to flat out prohibit we're proposing to prohibit minors from doing it at all, but the industry is very unhappy with that, and we kind of understand why after we had some discussions with a few of them. That would just impose another whole scheme, much like cigarettes or alcohol, and we heard that you know, they weren't really interested in that. So what we're proposing instead is the behind-the-counter requirement for pseudoephedrine, and that makes more sense to us, and that seems to be at least a developing trend in the Midwest, which is also numerically the hardest hit beyond the West Coast. So that's what I know.
Yes, Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the concerns, I support anything we can do to stop the meth labs. I was involved in negotiating a contract that would pay hazard pay 6% extra hazard pay up in Portland, the police who were involved in the Drugs and Vice Division. But I've heard from other people who have worried about this bill concerning the small mom-and-pop drug stores, especially in rural Oregon, and where they don't have, literally don't have a place to put it behind the counter. They don't have the space. And I would think that part of the argument about the same face where Walmart has a zillion checkers, the little guy doesn't. And so they have to go to the same face in those small stores. And I think it seems like this might be an undue hardship on the small stores.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I really can't see it being that way because they're already required to keep quite a number of other products behind the counter, such as cigarettes, and a lot of things are regulated in that way. And the mom-and-pop stores that I've been to, at least in Newport, they only have a couple of these products on the shelf. They've got probably the four that I've got you're seeing there. And all of them that at least I'm aware of have a behind-the-counter area where they keep, you know, racks and racks of cigarettes. I just can't see the burden here. On the other hand, if you look at, again, that quote we got directly from a Smurfer, that's exactly what he was doing, was going from mom-and-pop store to mom-and-pop store to mom-and-pop store. And I think that having it behind the counter levels the playing field and at the same time protects mom-and-pop from getting it stolen.
If I may, I live near a Bi-Mart, and I live in Aloha, and they have a huge display of that type of medicine, the cold medicines, and they're apparently not having a theft problem, or I assume they would do something about that to protect themselves. But for example, to buy the Schick Turbo 3 razor blades, they're locked up because they were going out the door by a truckload. So some of this, I mean, I would think if the retailers are having a problem with that they would, you know, take care of it themselves. I mean, obviously they can't afford the loss, but I have some concern about putting an undue burden on the retailers.
Mr. Chair, Representative, and I hear that concern. My other concern on the flip side of that, and I've seen some of the convenience stores, and the way they do loss prevention on the pseudoephedrine and a variety of things is just by placing them on an end cap right by the sales counter, which is a pretty effective way of loss prevention for the small mom-and-pop store. What I'm very concerned about is the potpourri hit-and-miss situation that we got right now in Oregon, with some people placing it behind the counter and others not, is we have two types of sales of pseudoephedrine, the legitimate and the non-legitimate. And I think by leveling the playing field, what we're doing is there's a built-in financial disincentive for people to put stuff behind the counter. because it's not quite as accessible to their customers. And I think the sales that are being lost by those stores are to the meth cooks, not to the legitimate guy that just wants to buy one box that's going to stop by the service counter. And so I think putting this stuff into statute is critical to level that playing field out so you don't have, I mean, you have all extremes. You have the mom and pop that could just be unknowingly selling stuff to a meth cook all the way up to the people that are selling it in cases right out the back door. So you got the full range, but I think it's real critical that we at least send the message to the guys like this that you can't go from mom and pop to mom and pop without asking for this particular product behind the counter. I think it poses a real impediment, if not nothing other, a mental impediment that you're actually having to go ask them to give you this product.
Okay, just one more follow-up.
One more.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not sure I understood about why you couldn't inspect records for iodine, because there was a state police case a number of years ago that involved a fish packer up in Rainier, and then the Supreme Court of the U.S. ruled on that based on a firearms that the police could go in and do special inspections of the records and the things people had. I don't know if that's changed or.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think that in that case, as in other cases I'm familiar with, those records are obtained pursuant to search warrant when there's probable cause to believe that, for example, in this case, iodine was dispensed unlawfully without the records or in huge quantities to non-wholesalers, so they go in and they seize the records pursuant to that method. What we're talking about here is suspicion that, for example, someone is not keeping the records required for the iodine sales and the ability to go in and say, hey, show me your records to make sure you're keeping the sales.
In that case, that was the argument. It was because they did not have a search warrant. They went in and said, show me your fish, show me your records. But anyway, okay, thank you very much.
Representative Shetterly.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I think the question's pretty much been asked by Representative Pruzanski. I had a question about the 2% too, and I guess all I would say is a comment. If we're going to be moving in that direction, just in fairness, so we know what the full impact is, it may be worth, I'd be interested to let that kind of circulate, because I know folks would have been looking at this at the 3.7 and probably not being prepared to come in to raise any issues as to dropping that to 2. And that's, I'd just be curious to know who all is encompassed in that difference.
Okay. Representative Cromwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a real simple question. If retailers in your counties have already been, or in Lincoln County anyway, have already been compliant on a voluntary basis, why do we need the bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that gets back to kind of the discussion we just had here. It's not universal. I think about half the stores right now do and half the stores don't. The half that don't are essentially selling a whole lot more ephedrine and pseudoephedrine products off the shelves, and I can't prove this, but I would urge you to believe that that's because that's where the meth cooks are going. And I think that if we impose this statute, this requirement, we level the playing field out.
Okay, thank you.
Additional questions? Representative Jensen, then we'll come back to Representative Pruzanski.
Thank you. Following on Representative Crummell's statement, you say that that half the stores are and half the stores aren't, and that the majority is being sold out of the one category and not the other. Do you have some actual data on that? I mean, is there a wholesale supplier that indicates that this is the case, or?
Mr. Chair, Representative, no, this is such a recent trend because it really didn't even start to go into effect until House Bill 3661 went into effect, which was January 1st of 2002. So we're really kind of new in this curve. I guess my summation that half are and half aren't is probably an overstatement. You know, it's probably less than half that are actually putting it behind the counter, but I know that particular less than half that has put it behind the counter is keeping behind the counter is moving a whole lot less of the stuff. I only know that anecdotally from discussions with the managers of these particular stores. I think you'd also find that Lincoln County is more unique among counties because we've been so proactive in getting out there and essentially asking our retailers to voluntarily put it behind the counter.
If I could also represent Williams and our Chair Williams and Representative Jensen, as an example, approximately 2 years ago, DEA, in conjunction with a number of state and local officers, did an undercover sting of several retail outlets, not only in Portland, but up and down the I-5 corridor all the way to Eugene. And
what they did was is they went in and literally bought large quantities of pseudoephedrine products and up to and including one final buy-busts, as we call them, was approximately 2,000, I think, individual bottles. It was like 10 cases. And the retailers knew exactly what they were selling the product for. And several of them got arrested as in being involved in the conspiracy to manufacture methamphetamine. So it is, and I'm not saying that there is a large majority of those out there, but you have people on both sides, and when Rob talks about leveling the playing field, I think that's exactly what we're talking about.
Yes, follow up, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On that, where the retailers knew exactly what they were selling it for, would having it behind the counter, if they're going to know exactly what they're selling it for, how would having it behind the counter?
Well, it's still, excuse me, Chair Williams and Representative Jensen, it still creates the issue when the prospective purchaser goes in there and sees it is behind the counter. Sometimes the assumption is that it's going to be more difficult to purchase here, and they will move down the road to a location where it is more easy for them to purchase.
If I could follow up.
Yes.
Chair Williams, Representative Jensen. The success that we're having from MSM and iodine sales is basically two-pronged. It's because of the retailer's knowledge now and cooperation with law enforcement about what these chemicals are being used for, but it's also what we've already spoke about is that it draws scrutiny on these people coming in, that if they know that they're going to have to face scrutiny, they're going to go somewhere else. And that's the main reason that these people, once they've gone to a farm grow and they've tried to purchase iodine, they know from the people that are in the community that they typically run with that if I go there, I'm going to draw scrutiny on myself, and I know people that have been taken down by law enforcement because of going there, they go somewhere else. So if we put a disadvantage to them going in and trying to get this pseudoephedrine or ephedrine, and they're going to draw scrutiny on themselves, the illegitimate people are going to go somewhere else. It's not going to be as readily available to them, and they're going to go somewhere else to get those chemicals.
Okay, Representative Prasansky.
And Sergeant, I don't know if you or Ms. Malti would be best to answer this question. Boxes of cold medicine, standard size, 24 tablets, whatever it may be. And if you can only sell three at a time to a person, how many boxes is that going to take before you can actually have a lab trying to produce the material? I understand from what Rob says that these economy of scale labs, that you can do 1 ounce to 9 grams, whatever it may be. But in realistic terms as to what you see and what you've seen out in the field, I mean, it doesn't sound to me that we're dealing with people that are going to go buy two or three boxes at one place and then try to turn that around. They're going to have to do these multiple stop and shops or stop and rob.
Mr. Chair, Representative, if I could answer that, maybe and answer another question that was just asked as well. I'll give you a real-world example from my hometown, Newport, and I won't name names, but we've got two major retailers there of this particular product. I can go into one right now, and I can buy a couple of dozen of these packages, which is, as a practical matter, what you'd kind of need to make a meth lab worth it to brew up some stuff. And I could buy it, and there would be no interference with me. I'd just go right through the U-scan. Now, that may have identified who it was, but I'd just go right through the U-scan about 10 times or 5 or 7 times or whatever it happens to be. It's all right off the shelf. I go across the street to the other store that's behind the counter. I couldn't even begin to. I could probably get one or two out of them. That would be about the most I could get. And that's the difference.
So, for clarification, it's going to take a dozen boxes or thereabouts before you've got people that are going to be ready to start cooking up a batch.
Well, Chair Williams, Representative Prasansky, no, it's not, because there are a number of small labs that are maybe don't produce a lot of methamphetamine, but they do cause a lot of problem within the community with contamination, fires, and et cetera. And basically, how it works out is this. If you have a bottle of 60 milligram pseudoephedrine, and you've got, and it's a 50 count bottle, you have 3 grams. So you can have 150 60 count pills. 3 grams will convert almost into 3 grams of methamphetamine, which is almost of an eighth of an ounce, which to some individuals is worth producing, trust me. And when we're talking about Nazi labs, those historically produce less than an ounce of methamphetamine.
Okay, additional questions for the panel? Representative Ackerman.
I haven't heard any testimony about, I guess it's Section 3, Subsection 3, regarding the sale to minors of these three additional precursors. Do you have anything on the record or any evidence which you can show that sales to minors of these precursors leads directly or indirectly to the manufacture of methamphetamine? I mean, documented types of cases.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we have a number of cases in the state of Oregon over the last year where essentially meth cooks have involved their children in smurfing. So you buy three, you buy three, you buy three, whatever it happens to be. I can't, for example, give you the particular example I have in Lincoln County because it's not a closed case yet. Because, again, we've only had this law on the book for a year. So I don't know if we have statistics. I don't know if the state police have statistics on that yet. I think it may be too early to have that. But in any event, we are abandoning our request to restrict the sales to minors. And that, the Dash 2 amendments include that abandonment.
Thank you.
Anything else? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions. First, what an ounce of methamphetamine run on the street? What kind of ranges?
Chair Williams, Representative Anderson. Right now, an ounce of methamphetamine will go anywhere between $450 to $650. And you're talking about an ounce of methamphetamine, first-time users could get approximately between 150 to 300 people high for 12 hours. That's okay. First-time users. So,
follow up?
Yes.
I understand then that the Dash 2 changes take it out of a real bind on the pharmacist or the retail store and just put it behind the counter. Is that correct?
Yes.
And then this does not restrict the sale of pediatric.
No.
Okay. It's mainly display, getting it
yes, sir.
Away from access.
Okay, anything else? All right, thank you very much. Marcia, do you want to come up? You've listed as four, and then we're going to bring up the opponents in a panel. But you're sort of hanging out there at the bottom of the list, so I thought we'd bring you on now.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Marcia Keith. I'm with Dave Barrows and Associates, and I'm here today representing the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association. And I will be brief. The Oregon Veterinary Medical Association is in support of House Bill 2034. As the previous witness, Rob Bovet, pointed out, there were some oversights or some unintended consequences of House Bill 3661, and a couple of those consequences caught the veterinarians. The current House Bill 2034 fixes the problem for the veterinarians. The amendments that Mr. Bovet has presented offer no difficulty for us, and he was kind enough to help us draft the Dash 3 amendments, which also clarify that veterinarians can dispense over-the-counter medications to a client or a patient. So those are the Those are the comments submitted by the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association, and we are definitely in support of the bill, and we would like to go on record thanking Mr. Bovet and the Oregon State Police for listening to the concerns that were raised after the passage of 3661 and fixing the situation for us in 2034.
Okay, are there any, thank you very much, Marcia. Are there any questions for Marcia about the bill? Yes, Representative Brzezinski.
Clarification on Dash 3s are the ones that are coming for, at the request of the Veterinary Medical Association?
Yes, sir. Mr.
So
Chair,
the doctor-patient versus the doctor-client relationship is referring to
Chair Williams, Representative Brzezinski, the doctor-client terminology is in there to clarify that the person that the veterinarian is interacting with is not the patient in this case, but the owner of the patient.
Right. I just wonder if this is the correct wording that you want.
Yeah, I think that's why they say doctor-client versus doctor-patient, right? Okay. Thank you. Anything else? Thank you very much, Marcia. All right, our next panel, we can pull an extra chair up and ask you to come up. Julie Brandis, Mike Sargent, Tom Holt, and Sean Miller.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Julie Brandis with Associated Oregon Industries and its retail council. I think I've explained to you before, AOI, among the other companies that we do represent the nation's largest retailers. At this point, I'm going to turn it over to Mike Sargent, who's here with us today from Washington, D.C., to talk about this bill.
Chairman Williams, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here this afternoon to talk to you about this important matter. My name is Mike Sargent, and I'm here today representing the Consumer Healthcare Products Association. CHPA is a trade association that represents the manufacturers of non-prescription medicines. Manufacturers include Johnson & Johnson, Procter & Gamble, Wyeth, a number of other manufacturers in the industry. In addition to that, a number of our manufacturers manufacture cough, cold, allergy products that include the active ingredient pseudoephedrine. So this issue is of great import to us, as it is to you here in Oregon and local law enforcement. I will say that we share the frustrations of local law enforcement on this issue, that we've worked a great deal with legislatures throughout the country, with state regulators, state's attorneys general, and state police and local narcotics agents on this issue. It's certainly a concern to our manufacturers when we see pseudoephedrine wind up in a clandestine methamphetamine lab. To that extent, we've worked very hard to help pass distribution with intent, possession with intent penalties throughout the country, specifically in 22 states. And we've also worked with local retail associations at passing what we consider to be meaningful but reasonable limits on the retail sale of certain products that contain pseudoephedrine. I think it's important for the record just to clarify what exactly is pseudoephedrine and what kind of products have pseudoephedrine in them. If I could just show you. This is what's commonly referred to as a single-entity pseudoephedrine product. It's available in brand names such as Sudafed, is the box I'm holding here. It's also available in Actifed, Equate, a number of their private label products. This single-entity product is typically the kind of product that you find in a methamphetamine lab. It's isolated by itself, the pseudoephedrine, and it's not in combination with any other drug ingredient. Pseudoephedrine, however, is also available in multiple cough, cold, allergy combination products. It's in liquid, tablet form, NyQuil, Tylenol cough, cold, Theraflu. Basically, any cough allergy medication that's out there and on the market today contains pseudoephedrine. It is the only FDA-approved nasal decongestant on the market. And so I think when we're talking about this ingredient, it's very important to make sure that we distinguish between what is a single-entity product and what is a combination product. That said, a number of retailers throughout the country have moved to voluntarily put these products behind the counter. And I do have to dispute what one of the things Mr. Bovet said, that I do not believe, and we've worked a great deal in the Midwest, there's not a trend in all of the Midwest to mandate that these products be put behind the counter. If you were to put every single product behind the counter that contains pseudoephedrine, you'd be literally talking about 50-plus feet of linear shelf space in some instances. It's a tremendous amount of product, and it would saddle retailers with a tremendous responsibility, not to mention cost. There are a number of localities in the state of Missouri that have passed single entity restrictions, meaning products that contain single entity pseudoephedrine would be required to go behind the counter. Those are in seven localities, but there's not a single statewide law that requires that. And I will say that that action in Missouri was initiated at the request of some retailers because it was such a loss prevention issue. I mean, they were having a tremendous amount of products stolen, local regulators in those parts of in that part of the state felt it was important to take that single entity product and mandate it behind the counter. But under no circumstances do we see statewide requirements, and nowhere do we see a requirement for a combination product to be put behind the counter. So we would be concerned about an amendment to this bill that would insert that kind of requirement into the bill. At the same time, I want to be sensitive to the fact that this is a very important issue, and we worked last year with the retailers in the state to get the three-package 9-gram retail sales limit passed. We think that's a meaningful piece of legislation. There are six other states that presently have that in effect, and we see that it's working. In addition, we support possession with intent penalties and distribution with intent penalties, and we've also worked with state attorneys general on this issue. In fact, we just met with Attorney General Drew Edmondson in Oklahoma last summer. He filed civil action against rogue wholesale distributors of pseudoephedrine, seeking an immediate injunction against them operating in that state, and in addition to leveling civil penalties against those companies for meth lab cleanup. We think that's an appropriate direction to take, and we'd be happy to work with officials in Oregon on that issue. So I just want to state for the record that while we oppose what's being proposed here today, we certainly do not impose what we consider to be reasonable limitations on the sale of this product. Those are my primary objections to this legislation and the proposed amendments. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Sergeant. We'll hold questions until the panel has had a chance to speak, and then we'll come back and get specific. Please proceed, Mr. Miller.
Great. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Sean Miller. I represent the Oregon Grocery Association and the Oregon Community Pharmacy Council. Pharmacy Council is comprised of the chain drug stores and the Grocery Association comprised of the chain grocery stores such as Safeway, Fred Meyer, on down to your independent smaller stores, including some convenience stores such as 7-Eleven, who are members. Here representing that particular section of the retail industry in opposition to House Bill 2034, I'd like to just address some of the sections within the bill and then also address the amendments and some of the questions that were asked by the committee. Specifically, Section 3, Sub 3 in the bill that deals with selling to a minor. Representative Ackerman raised the question of the link between a minor and the actual manufacture of methamphetamine. And, we have not seen any data out there to prove that a minor is actually the one producing and making methamphetamine. In fact, when you actually look at the age groups that are out there making, we would argue that it would be people above 18 years of age. I think when you hit 18, you're moving out of the house. Most people, when they're 17 and under, are living in a house to manufacture this kind of drug. You need to own property. It's not something that most people aren't doing it in their basement, and if they do, mom and dad would probably smell that or come on to come on to the drug. So it's an issue that I think on the sale of it, there's really not that link. Obviously, this is something that the retail community would have to card for, and I want to point out on the you have in front of you, if you look, there's a 7-page document provided. Gary Oxley, representing Fred Meyer, produced this document. It's a 7-page document of 295 products, and the products that we're talking about today.
If you take all of these products under the particular bill, we would have to CAR on each one of these items for minors. On the Dash 2 amendments that were proposed to actually move these behind the counter, it would take 60 lineal feet of shelf space to put these products on the shelf, which are the same products you find walking into a Fred Meyer. Obviously, different retail outlets sell a variety of these different items, but we're talking about a large number of space that if you require it behind the counter, would take actually major renovations. And Representative Barker referenced Bi-Mart. They have a very large pharmacy section. If you require that even in a Bi-Mart, they would have to remodel the store to provide all their products that you see here on this list behind the counter. So a tremendous burden. One of the comments that was made by the previous testimony is in the law enforcement. I do want to talk briefly about 3661 because we did work really hard last session. The industry came to the table and said we are willing to support a limit of the sale of these items. Now, we are in the business of selling out of a retail outlet, so we are obviously very sensitive to this particular item being used as a precursor drug. So we came and we actually supported in actually the chair's committee last session this limit. We're doing a lot more this session on the theft issue. I think theft is a big issue to us. It's even gotten larger, and we're doing things. We've talked about voluntarily moving things behind, but we're also talking about being able to give us more of the tools to be able to get some of these shoplifters as well. And again, these are issues that we need the tools to be able to stop some of this theft from occurring. When you look at one of the previous people that testified talked about their declining budget and some of the law enforcement, maybe less people out there being able to prosecute and go after these people. And, you know, quite honestly, I know we're in a budget crisis, but this particular bill seems to put the entire burden on the retail community. And we believe and strongly believe that 3661 did give the tools to law enforcement to do the job. It also, from the retail perspective, provided us and required us to do a lot more training. But I'm telling you, this list, this seven-page list, we have to train all of our clerks how to handle the sale of these and limit the sale because we're responsible if more than the required amount goes out the door. And so we take it very seriously. Each chain, even down to the small independent, takes it very seriously on educating our clerks. And so, you know, the putting the burden entirely on the retail community, we believe that 3661 gave law enforcement the tools to go after this. And this bill goes a step too far. And so I will just conclude, you know, my remarks that we're opposed to the Section 3, Sub 3, selling the minors and the Dash 2 amendments for which I've outlined. And again, I want you to just take a look at what Gary put together. And you look through there, it's a long list, seven pages. And I paced off in the hallway what 60 lineal feet, just so you can kind of put that in perspective. It's probably the entire side of this sidewall of the committee is roughly around 60 feet. And so obviously, you know, we'd have shelves above that, but you could actually look at what the required number of space if you were to require that behind the counter and look at that and say, well, that's almost a wall in some of our smaller stores. And so the requirement that you're asking us to do here in the proposal. And I will conclude my remarks there, Mr. Chair, and ask any questions at the end.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. Mr. Holt.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tom Holt. I'm Executive Director of the Oregon State Pharmacists Association. Our members are practicing pharmacists in retail, hospital, long-term care, and other settings throughout the state. I'll be brief. In general, I would agree with all the comments made by others on this panel, but I'd like to underscore a couple of points. One, the issue of putting these products behind the counter is not a small one in terms of remodeling. There are many pharmacies both independents and chains that have their actual pharmacy working area is quite small in terms of square footage. And to be able to put all of these things behind the counter would require remodeling in most pharmacies that I've been into, and in my work I've been into nearly all of those in this state. The other issue here too, in terms of putting these behind the counter, is can create some operational problems for the pharmacy, and that if the product is going to be dispensed through the pharmacy counter, that's going to create an interaction with pharmacy technicians who are not within their scope of practice, supposed to counsel people about their over-the-counter medications. That means the pharmacist is going to have to get involved, and given the workloads that pharmacies are already facing in very fast rising utilization of prescription drugs relative to the number of people we have actually entering the profession, it'll be one more workload problem for the pharmacy. We absolutely share the concerns expressed by the previous panel about methamphetamine and the related problems. And I would note that one of the members of the previous panel testified that 3661 has decreased access to these products. I'd suggest that this is working. It's working fairly well. It's a young process, however, and we should give it a chance to work before we add any additional regulation on our outlets. And with that, I'll conclude. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Holt.
Mr. Chair, just in summary, and then I know Mike has one more comment, but I think the industry sees it this way. House Bill 3661 from last session is working. It was an agreement by the parties to put limits on the amount of sales in the state. Many of our stores do volunteer to put certain products behind the counter. I would argue when it comes to preventing a crime, as shoplifting is, we also have to put things like baby formula behind the counter. And the sale of baby formula on the black market, those profits generally go to drug processes like, you know, making meth. So we do our best in our stores to prevent theft. I think Sean mentioned to you that we have a variety of bills that will be coming before this committee at some point this session, so we can address the problem of why you would need to put it behind the counter in the first place. Again, we don't see it as a solution because our stores are limited. Some of our stores are limited in their ability to put this amount of product behind the counter. And establishing a system, even though we live in the high-tech world, still establishing a system and training our employees, the companies that we represent, to card for 7 pages of product is overwhelming at best. As you know, there have been sting operations in related to alcohol, and generally it's the mistake of the checker. So, again, those are some of the concerns that we have in summary, but I know Mike has one more comment he'd like to make.
Yes, Mr. Sergeant.
Mr. Chairman, just for the record, I just wanted to make it clear to the committee, my original comments focused primarily on the behind-the-counter proposal that was brought up via the amendment, and I just wanted to make sure for the record that I raised my original concern about this bill, which is the age restriction. Just by way of what another state has done, there, as I said before, there are 6 states that have passed the 3-package 9-gram retail sales limit, including Oregon. Only one of those states that has the 3-9 limit, Arkansas, has passed an age restriction. And presently, the Judiciary Committee in that state this year is taking up a change in that statute to eliminate that age restriction because of the nature of the civil penalties that have been levied against retailers for minors coming in and trying to buy legitimate cough, cold allergy products. There are a number of reasons why minors would want to buy a cough, cold, allergy product with pseudoephedrine. Ephedrine, for example, is used in a number with the drug ingredient guaifenesin and products like Primatine and Bronchade. That product is used by asthmatics. Asthmatics usually use RX drugs, but in some cases for immediate asthma relief, they look to those OTC drugs to provide instant relief. A child running an errand for a parent, or, as we discussed earlier, a single mother who is under the age of 18, quite frankly, would need to buy such products for her children. So there are a host of problems with that kind of proposal, and as I said before, we just think it goes too far, and that's our only concern. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Sergeant. I had a couple of questions for the panel before I turn it over to other committee members. Now, you heard the proponents of the bill indicate that they've dropped in their own request the carding for minors requirement from the bill, and that's included in the Dash 2 amendment. And you all testified about your concerns about the behind-the-counter portions of the bill. Beyond those two issues, which you now testified on, are there any of the other changes proposed in the bill related to the original bill that was passed last session that you have any objections to?
No.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, no. I think all the housekeeping items, and there's other changes in here that do not involve the retail industry, I think we are fine with.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would like to check one of those amendments with the hospitals. I don't see them here today, which is probably a good sign, but I think I heard the panel say they didn't think it impacted the hospitals. We can just clarify that relatively quickly.
Mr. Holt?
Mr. Chair, I also would like to check the percentage issue with my technical people.
Okay.
But otherwise, no objections with those items removed.
Let me ask this. My next question is, of the list that has the seven pages of potentially restricted items, how many of these are actually, and I think that I heard you use the word, let's see if I get it right, single entity drugs. So how many of the list that we've got here are actually single entity drugs?
Mr. Chairman, I have not had an opportunity to look at that list. I can tell you that there are a significant number of single entity pseudoephedrine products on the market. You know, again, as I said, Sudafed is a brand that's most commonly thought of, but there's Actifed. There are numerous private label products. There's Equate. There are a number of brands out there. What I can tell you is that again, it's the only FDA-approved nasal decongestant available on the market, and the single entity product is primarily used by allergy sufferers. When you see it in combination with other products like acetaminophen, which is an analgesic, a painkiller, or diphenhydramine, which is an antihistamine, you see it used by persons who are suffering from colds. But again, it's frequently used, and I can say frequently used in moderation, and we think the 3-package 9-gram sales limit really is a meaningful policy.
And you referenced, I think it was Missouri, where at least in some jurisdictions in Missouri they put the single entity behind the counter, is that right?
That is correct. There are seven localities in Missouri. I can't name them all. St. Louis is one of them, but there are others that have passed local ordinances to require single entity to go behind the counter. We opposed those proposals primarily because there were mandates on retailers. The problem was that they were having a tremendous amount of theft in those localities. Law enforcement was then being called upon to respond to that theft, and the mayors and the council members of those towns found it that it was an appropriate solution to mandate the behind the counter provision. I will also say that action was followed by a number of retailers voluntarily putting it behind the counter, but they also opposed the mandates.
John, at some point, could you get us the list that differentiates between the single entity and the non-single entity products?
Mr. Chair, yeah, I will try to break that down under these seven pages. I can't tell you that every one of these items is currently restricted under 3661 of the sale,
right,
but we will try to identify that within this list.
Good. Okay. Other questions for the panel? Yes, Representative Anders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you give me an idea of the difference in concentration between the single entity and the combinations? Is it 2-to-1, 3-to-1?
Let me just take a look. This is 120 milligrams. It varies in therapeutic doses from product to product. Sometimes you'll have 30 milligram tablets. Sometimes you'll have, for example, this is a 12-hour product, so it's 120 milligrams. This is a combination product, and this is 30 milligrams of the pseudoephedrine. So it varies brand by brand, product by product, based on what the recommended dosage is. And some people prefer to take it on a more routine basis. Others prefer sort of a 12-hour therapeutic dose.
Significantly different, though.
Absolutely.
Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to direct this question to Mr. Miller, but actually it would be, you can readily pass it on to anyone else if there's a better person to respond. My question is there any other product under Oregon law that is required to be held behind the counter that is not also restricted as to who can purchase it, because what I understand the proposal to be here is that we will not restrict who can purchase, but we require any purchaser to ask for it from a behind-the-counter location.
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, I believe there's only one product, but it doesn't, and that's tobacco. But that restricts the sale of who can buy it. So this would be the only product, I believe, if I'm hearing your question, that would be required behind the counter and not restricted of who could buy it.
Right. That's responsive to my question.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Thank you very much. We appreciate your time. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2034. And a couple of matters of business, colleagues, before we move into the next bill. And I'd like you to, if you could, stay with us through this next bill. I think it will be relatively quick. I want to do the bill introduction today while we are maintaining our quorum. You have LC 2022, LC 2485 in front of you. Authorizes Department of Corrections to enter into contracts for provision of correctional services and facilities out of state is 2485, and LC 2022 expands the crime of arson in the first degree. Those are the two bills before you for committee introduction. Is there any discussion? Then the chair would move that LC 2022 and LC 2485 be introduced as committee bills with the standard proviso that your support of this motion does in no way indicate support or opposition to the bills. Is there any objection? Hearing none, the bills are introduced as committee bills. Also want to remind the committee that there is no Judiciary Committee meeting tomorrow. There will be no Judiciary Committee meeting tomorrow afternoon. But would also remind you that tomorrow from 11:30 till at least probably pushing 1 o'clock is the committee's lunch meeting with the members of the Supreme Court, the tax court judge, and the chief judge of the Court of Appeals at the Supreme Court building. So we'll be having lunch tomorrow beginning at 11:30 with them, but we will not be having a committee meeting tomorrow. So, if you can push around a golf in or whatever you plan to do tomorrow afternoon, I encourage you to do that. Okay, with that, we are going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2576. And I will call Mr. DeLashmit, Lonnie Hitchcock, it looks like FOPO.
FOPO. Organization.
Lisa Siddle and Rick McKenna. Yeah, somebody should have said that FOPO wasn't part of the last name, right?
While they're getting set, just for the record, my name is Brian DeLashman. I'm here representing the Federation of Oregon Parole and Probation Officers and also the Oregon Council of Police Associations. Very straightforward bill today, but let me just, I'll try and be extremely brief. The history of this bill, which you're probably all aware, that in the state statute under collective bargaining, we have basically two different sets of systems, one for those that are able to strike and those that are barred from striking. When the public sector collective bargaining was originally written and continues to this day, the basis for those that are strike barred is that they are so essential to the public safety, health, and welfare of the state of Oregon and its citizens that those employees should never be allowed to strike. There should be an alternative set up for a resolution of a contract dispute when the two parties up until that point cannot come to resolution through either interest arbitration or regular sitting across the table or any other setup that they in fact design as far as the actual process that they would use in their individual county. This was the practice in the state for years and years. When the state went out of the business of being in charge of parole and probation officers and the counties took over the chore, the counties looked at the statute. In reading the actual language of the statute, it did not specifically mention parole and probation officers as being barred from striking, even though the state, when they were under their control, deemed it essential and did not protest that. The ERB board reversed itself and said basically that Since they're not specifically listed in the statute as being barred from striking, we would allow them to go ahead and strike, so they took them out of the strike barred situation. So the second point I'd like to make is that you may in fact hear today that binding arbitration as a dispute resolution is not perfect. We would agree with that from the employer's side and the employee's side, the way current binding arbitration is set up, and we would encourage both employers and employees to work to a different setup of binding arbitration. But that's not the issue today. The issue in front of you today is whether or not folks that are so essential to public safety should be barred from striking, because if they're not on the job, there's people out there that are going undersupervised, and I would hope that you focus on that. The second point that third point I'd like to make is that this issue also has nothing to do with who is in police and fire and PERS. The contention was made 2 years ago that this is a way for parole and probation officers to get police and fire under PERS, which is a different calculation than the general service. I would contend that that issue has been resolved. There was a bill that was passed last session in which the parole and probation officers and the counties got together, worked out a resolution. So those counties that in fact already have parole and probation officers that are in PERS and are police and fire, they would stay in that, and it's negotiated. Those that are not, that in fact is negotiated, and the county does not have to pay police and fire. So that's a non-issue. With that, I'll turn it over to Lonnie, and we'll try and go quickly through this. I know it's been a long day. I've learned more about meth today. If you want to learn more about meth, I think a lot of these people could probably tell you a lot about what they see is going on with meth.
In the interim, we watched the federal drug folks,
DEA.
The DEA. We watched their video, and they taught the committee actually how to make it. So, I mean, it's we know a fair amount about it at this stage of the
Mr.
game.
Mr. Chair, you don't need to go to DEA to get that education. Yeah, you can just go out in the streets.
Yeah, that's probably true. Welcome, and please begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Lonnie Hitchcock. I've been a parole and probation officer in Clackamas County for the past 25 years. Most of my time I spent in sex crimes and homicide doing pre-sentence investigations, but in the last 7 years I've been a probation officer for the DUII case bank. About a third of those people are unfortunately people who drive under the influence of methamphetamine, and I'm not going to go on about that because you certainly heard enough about that today. I have 630 people currently on my caseload. I operate that alone. I use a computer extensively, and I do have an assistant that helps me. My responsibility is to see that these people get into and complete treatment, and I will arrest in 10 months 400 of them. If I can't get them arrested, there'll be a warrant out for their arrest. This is an extremely active and volatile caseload. During the year of 2002, I took 129 calls in the middle of the night while I was asleep, which resulted in 129 warrants that I issued over the phone. If I'm not there, and when I'm not there, which I wasn't because of an unfortunate surgery I had to have on my knee, the whole thing fell apart and it was a mess, and people all over the county were drinking and out of control because there was no one watching my caseload. We almost went on strike 3 years ago in Clackamas County, and that was a pretty scary situation. Offenders will act out when they know that they're not being watched. The only tool that I really have is that they're terrified of me, and my name in Clackamas County is a big one. They are frightened. If I walk into a bar in Clackamas County, half the room empties out, whether they're on probation to me or not, because they were previously. It's a very high-profile job, unfortunately, and I know I look very meek today, but I don't know that. But in general, I'm a pretty frightening person when it comes to drunk drivers in Clackamas County. We prevent crime, and I think that's another reason why we need to be strike-barred. We actually prevent crime. When a police officer calls me and says, I've got your guy, he's drunk, he's in the car with somebody else, he's not driving, I'm going to arrest him anyway. Maybe he only spends one night in jail, but he or she will be sober when they get out of jail in the morning. Just because they're in a car with someone else at the moment that I have them arrested doesn't mean that they're not going to be driving somebody's car a few minutes later and kill somebody. So far, I've only had in the past 7 years about four crashes happen where people were hurt. No one has died yet. When that happens, I will be sued. I know that the counties will be sued. Some of the information that you've been given is about some of the lawsuits as relate to sex offenders. I don't even want to get into the sex offender issue because I could talk about that forever since that was my primary focus during my career. When I started in the 70s, we had 6,000 people in the state under supervision. In 1998, we had 27,000. Now we have 41,856. I believe that was as of yesterday, people under supervision. The numbers are astronomical. To even lose one county to a strike would have a tremendous impact on crime and on those people perceiving that they're going to be able to get away with whatever they're going to get away with because they're not being watched in the community. And I thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Lisa Sattel, and I'm a parole and probation officer with Yamhill County. I've been a PO with Yamhill County for the last 14 years, and over that time period, I've supervised just about every type of caseload that most POs supervise, anywhere from domestic violence to DUI offenders like Lonnie. I spent some time working with sex offenders, and primarily over the last 2 years, I've been supervising a caseload of high-risk drug and property offenders. So very familiar with what the officers were talking about here in the last hour about methamphetamine. Currently in Yamhill County, which is one of our smaller rural counties, we have 11 parole and probation officers currently supervising 1,400 people on supervision. In May, we have two officers who are retiring, and those caseloads will not, or those POs will not be able to be replaced due to budget cuts. So that leaves us 9 POs, 1,400 people. That's an average of 155 per probation officer. As parole and probation officers, we take an oath that we will protect the community and attempt to rehabilitate the offenders that we have under supervision. Should contract negotiations break down between the officers and the county at the time of collective bargaining, our only option at this point is to strike. This is completely contrary to the oath that we take. POs not only swear to protect the community, but we put our lives and invest our lives in doing so. Striking is something that we don't want to do, and it is not something that we believe is in the best interest of the community. We do our job because we want to keep our community safe, and we've been trained to do so with interview, counseling, and defensive skills from the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. Not anyone can work with the offenders that we do. Most of these offenders have spent their lives calculating how to take advantage of others, and they'll fight for what they believe in. If we were to strike, the county could not temporarily hire someone to do our jobs. We are certified officers with the power of arrest and search and seizure. We have had years of training dealing with criminal personalities. Throughout the weeks, as the year progresses, we have the occasion to lodge our offenders once they violated the terms of their supervision. These violations could be anything from consuming alcohol or drugs, having possession of weapons, being in contact with victims that they're prohibited from contacting. No one but a parole and probation officer has the authority to lodge someone in jail for violating their supervision outside of the judge. Police officers cannot make this call. I would encourage that and ask that you help us keep our community safe and keep those people who are trained and certified on the job.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. And I appreciate you abbreviating your testimony. We are a bit pressed for time, and so it is, I think, going to be most helpful to hear a little bit about what you do in your particular area as a parole and probation officer, and then allow the committee to ask any questions that they have before we bring up the next panel. And so I turn the time over to you. Is it Mr. Settle? Is that right?
No.
Oh, okay.
I'm Rick McKenna.
Okay.
Chairman.
Great.
I'm the commander of the Parole and Probation Division for the Marion County Sheriff's Office. I'll preface my remarks by saying my remarks are mine. Here I'm not representing the county in this particular instance.
Right.
Usually the people sitting to the right of me are on the opposite side of the bargaining table. I represent management here, but I am here in support of House Bill 2576. And there are a number of reasons why that's the case. I don't need to go through the litany of changes that have been made, and particularly over the last 10 years in parole and probation officer duties. Everything from optional arming of POs, which has increased tremendously, the interface with law enforcement and community policing, structured sanctions. You heard from both the POs, how they have now the ability not only to arrest but to impose sanctions. We've seen sex offender notification become a huge issue. Caseloads that have become specific in that area. Domestic violence, another arena where the assault for felony has increased the number of cases that we're responsible for. Also brought about specialized caseloads. In Marion County, we have a particular problem with gang enforcement, a caseload entirely devoted to the supervision of what the Department of Corrections refers to as the security threat group. You heard testimony earlier about the proliferation of drug cases, which we've seen statewide and heavily in this county. I believe, unfortunately, we're leading the state in the number of meth labs that were discovered. A couple of those were found by parole and probation officers out in the field. The Department of Corrections has undertaken a massive effort to improve transition planning, which directly relates to parole and probation officers. So from my standpoint, why am I interested in this, since I'm on the management side of it? Well, we came very close ourselves in Marion County to strike, where we were actually developing, an alternative plan. How are we going to address the issues? How are we going to manage, this significant caseload and all the risks that it presents out here? And to say it was a challenging effort is to hugely underestimate it. We had five staff, 3,500 clients that would have been under our supervision had a strike gone forward. And how long that could have been is anybody's guess here as well. I do know from the process of collective bargaining that we've been able, at least in our county, to follow through with at least modified interest-based bargaining, which has kept our system, if you will, chugging along here. Frankly, I don't see anything from the strike bar prohibited units in Marion County, which includes the County Law Enforcement Association, that make this significantly different in terms of the contracts with the Federation of Parole and Probation Officers and the units that are strike bar. I just don't see, where other than the fact, that this, in my opinion, critically sensitive group of people, would not be have the option of going out on strike and leaving us in a situation where we have, few viable options. And I'll stop there. I did also hand out to the committee representation of some articles from the Tacoma Tribune, including their website, largely because I think that series does a tremendous job of giving an overview of not only parole and probation and what it's about, but the risks and the liability that have come to be a huge piece of corrections across the nation. And to our near neighbor, it's meant millions of dollars in lawsuits, regarding a failure to supervise issues, which I only see as being exacerbated by the potential of a strike. And again, in the interest of brevity, I'll stop there and answer any questions you may have.
Great. Thank you,
Mr. Chair. Just the one thing I neglected to do, you have written testimony that I submitted from Randy Settle, rather than him. He is here, but we've submitted the written testimony. And I did give you also the written history of the collective bargaining section.
Good, and we appreciate you providing that testimony, and it'll be made part of the committee record. Are there questions? I think the impact of this, at least from what it does, is fairly straightforward. Are there any specific questions from the committee to the panel? Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In relationship to it is unlawful, it shall be unlawful to strike or recognize a picket line. What's the consequences?
My understanding, and I'd have to look to the people that do the labor law in the back of the room, but my assumption would be it's an unfair labor practice to do that. And there are sanctions based on the Public Sector Collective Bargaining Act in the state.
Is that, may I follow?
Yes, you may.
Is that the, have the same effect as a management labor negotiator a few years ago that I was familiar with said that unfair labor practice and $2 will get you a cup of coffee anywhere in town?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, the ERB board has the ability in the state to make sanctions. They have done so. They continue to do so under the current structure, and I guess maybe I'd respectfully disagree with the person that you quoted.
Okay. Anything else? Okay, thank you. Our last two witnesses today, if we can stick together on this committee, is Paul Snyder and Maria Keltner, I think, is if I got that right.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties, and with me this afternoon is Maria Keltner, the director of the Local Government Personnel Institute, also representing Association of Oregon Counties.
Welcome, Ms. Keltner. Please proceed.
Yeah. Good afternoon, Chair Williams and members of the House Judiciary Committee. All 36 counties in Oregon are members of the Association of Oregon Counties, and these counties, through the AOC, oppose House Bill 2576. House Bill 2576 would require interest arbitration to settle disputes over collective bargaining contract terms and conditions for county adult parole and probation officers. As you heard the testimony before, those bargaining units in Oregon under Oregon's law that are prohibited from striking are mandated with their employers to go to binding interest arbitration, where an outside third party sets the terms and conditions of the collective bargaining agreement, selecting either the package that is proposed by management of the county or the package that is proposed by the union. Counties have historically and continue to oppose adding groups of folks to the group of people, that narrow group of people that are prohibited from striking and are therefore subject to interest arbitration. House Bill 2576 would replace a system that has worked and has been working with a process that is more costly and is a mandate. The parties can, under current law, voluntarily agree, county and their parole and probation officers or their group of employees can voluntarily agree to go to interest arbitration if they're not able to bargain and reach agreement on a collective bargaining agreement. That's in the current law. That is open to them. They can negotiate and do that. Under current law, the public is also protected. Under ORS 243-726 sub 3, county can go to the court and request an injunction if there is a clear and present danger or threat to the health, safety, or welfare of the public. And that is either before the strike takes place or after the strike is ongoing, that they can go to court and get an injunction. So it's not necessary to add adult and probation officers to that narrow group of employees that are strike prohibited, because in the event that there would be an inherent threat to public danger, it can be addressed on a case-by-case basis by going to the court and seeking relief through an injunction. In addition, House Bill 2576 disrupts the current labor relations and fragments existing bargaining units, adding another collective bargaining relationship to the collective bargaining chore task of counties in terms of dealing with the employees. They would have to disrupt current bargaining units by altering them to separate out those parole and probation officers who would no longer be permitted to strike. They're currently mixed with employees that can strike. So those bargaining units would need to be separated out. The last reason that the Association of Oregon Counties opposes House Bill 2576, or at least the last reason I'm going to be talking to you about today, is that it creates a disincentive to bargain to agreement. A tactical desire to have interest arbitration as a way to resolve collective bargaining disputes has a tendency to have the bargaining forum become a stage or a process for playing to a third-party interest arbitrator instead of building a constructive relationship between the parties to resolve their disputes. Counties value county employees. Counties value parole and probation officers. This is not about the value of the employees. It's about supporting the current collective bargaining process where parties negotiate to agreement over the terms and conditions of the collective bargaining agreement, and a process where the parties are free to negotiate over even the term of whether or not to go to interest arbitration to resolve collective bargaining dispute. So the association would urge a no vote on House Bill 2576.
Thank you, Ms. Kellner. I guess, and I'll start off with a question. The trouble that I have with the analysis that you provided, which I think is very accurate from a standpoint of a labor management policy discussion about the effects and operations of binding last offer arbitration, is that I find it very, very difficult to draw any kind of a distinction from a public safety standpoint, which is my role as a policymaker here in this committee, to draw any significant distinction between providing that level of no-strike support for a law enforcement officer, whether it be a police officer or a sheriff or somebody else in that on-the-line responsibility, and somebody who's a parole and probation officer who, in my experience in this committee, is doing as much in the area of law enforcement, crime prevention, peacekeeping, crime avoidance as anybody else. And while I recognize that the county could run under that statute to the courthouse and ask for some sort of injunctive relief to force those people to go back to work, it's A, no guarantee that the judge would necessarily grant it if it was being opposed, and B, as a litigator in my private practice, there is a time lag there. I mean, that just doesn't happen necessarily overnight, and so there would be at least some disruption in the services being provided if this particular group of people went on strike. And so I have a very difficult time in drawing that line at this level and saying one group ought to be in and one group ought to be out if we're going to make the public safety concept of law enforcement part of that approach. I guess I'd be interested in your response.
Paul is the expert on parole and probation versus police officers, so I'll defer to him.
Well, I'd be interested in Paul's response.
Mr. Chair, a while ago, and to my knowledge, continuing to this day, has been the dialogue that's been going on within parole and probation over the question, are we here to help people turn their lives around, or are we here to catch them in the act of doing something wrong? The one approach, this latter approach, is what's been referred to in the parlance as tail 'em, nail 'em, and jail 'em. The other approach is to help people turn around. I think parole and probation officers do a combination of those things every day. On the one hand, they're involved with finding out, identifying whether or not offenders are doing something that's a violation of the law. And on the other hand, they're trying to get people to turn their lives around to become more productive. And so, in a sense, parole and probation officers are kind of one foot in one side and the other foot in the other side. There have not been a great many parole or probation officer strikes in the past, which isn't to say they might not just be around the corner. But we use the past to give us a sense for what the future looks like. And judging from the past, it's unlikely. It hasn't happened very often. And when it does happen, we try and cover that through management. If we can't cover it through management, then we take it to the court. It's the view of the Association of Oregon Counties that this is more about economics, that it's a matter of increasing the bargaining power of the union and decreasing the bargaining power of management, And the impact of that essentially is going to be increased costs for the current services that we get.
Okay. I'm going to go to Representative Barker, then Representative Prozanski, and I do want to remind the committee that we're 20 minutes over our time, right? Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On Senate Bill 750 that Senator Neil Bryant crafted a few years back, which dramatically changed public employee collective bargaining, I was opposed to that. I was on the other side of that issue. And post-Senate Bill 750, for a while I was tracking arbitration cases. The management side, if you will, was winning virtually all of those. The police and fire were losing those because this bill, I thought, was weighted the other way. Maybe you would say it was weighted more fairly, but I don't see people going to arbitration just willy-nilly, and especially with the one-side wins where they used to mix and match. And I'll just say one further thing about parole and probation officer. I was a policeman 31 years. I spent a lot of that time as a blue shirt, you know, out working in the street. And I would go side by side with parole and probation on search warrants and all kinds of things. And I see them more as law enforcement. And vitally necessary they not be allowed to strike. And I tend to support this bill because of that. Thank you.
Representative Prozanski.
Oh, I'm not sure. I'm not sure how management at this point would be taking the position that that you'd be in opposition to this bill, except for that I feel that counties are probably in a better position than P&P employees because they really have no option except to strike. And if they try to strike, as we heard in the testimony, they can always be forced back to work. And so I'm not sure really what benefit we have in the sense of forcing someone to actually go to a strike mode, forcing the courts to have to require those individuals to continue to work and still have some type of negotiations going on, which may never bear fruit or take some time. And it seems to me that if the two parties can work in good faith, that they will reach an agreement. If not, then it would require some type of mandatory arbitration to resolve the situation either way. It just seems that I'm going to have difficulty at this point not supporting this bill because I do believe, as Representative Barker said, these individuals are in fact a component of the corrections and law enforcement. And clearly when we went to 1145 structuring, I think that we really did shift more emphasis on their participation in law enforcement.
Anything else? Okay. Then I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2576. It's the chair's intention to open a work session, and I'll do that now on House Bill 2576. I want to make it clear that I'm not in my support of House Bill 2576 trying to upset any kind of fruit basket with respect to labor and management on this issue. What I will say is that I believe that given our current budget circumstances and the overview that we have all had over the last couple of 4 or 5 weeks of the public safety system and the challenges that we're going to be facing to run a public safety system on substantially reduced dollars, I'm not willing to take the risk as various counties go into these difficult budget circumstances and contract negotiations are coming up that we're going to leave any county out there potentially in a situation where we have these people not being monitored through parole and probation because the union has felt they have no other alternative but to go to strike to resolve a dispute. I would much rather take the lumps of binding mandatory arbitration in that circumstance and make sure that these group of people that parole and probation are responsible to monitor, both to try to get their lives back on track, but at the same time to make sure that the dangerous ones who aren't are getting back into the system and not committing any additional crime and additional victims as quickly as possible. That I think, and I view this particularly in this budget circumstance, as a public safety issue for me and that alone. So those are my comments to why I'll be supporting the bill as I make a motion here in a minute, but I want to give Representative Jensen an opportunity as he's indicated interest.
Oh, I'm happy to wait till the motion is made, but I'm also happy to go now.
No, feel free, Representative Jensen.
Thank you. I'm going to support the bill today. I have to admit that if we were talking about Section 1, Sub 1 of this bill, as to either delete it or include it, I might have a somewhat different position on this. But I tend to very much agree with the chair and with my good colleague, Representative Barker over here, on the role of probation and parole officers. And their difficult job in public safety. However, I think, colleagues, we're on a somewhat slippery slope with this, because there are a number of other areas, I think, that may very well qualify into the same thing. And I'm looking at here that a mental institution, a mental hospital, people would be prohibited from striking. But there's no inclusion in the legislation or in the law that the crisis or emergency worker in county mental health clinics would be included in that category. Since I live with a lady who spent her career in mental health, and on one occasion at least spent 2 hours sitting across the table from a gentleman with a loaded .38, not sure whether he was going to shoot her before he shot himself or just shoot himself first. I'd argue that there are probably a lot of areas in public safety that may fall into the same domain that we're dealing with here. And I'm not sure how far someday we're going to want to go with that.
I think the representative's point is well taken. Representative Anderson.
Yes, looks like I may be on the opposite side of the fence for once here. And I think while I would hate to see strikes occur, and I relate quite well to the testimony we heard in favor, I think in my mind this is an issue of a county or a local government being able to make up their own decision rather than being pulled into a statewide type of bargaining. So I think I'll probably take the other side and vote against it.
Okay. Is there any other comments? Representative Crumwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just very briefly, I guess and somewhat to counter my good colleague who also came out of local government from Grants Pass, I guess the question that I would ask is how often do arbitrators agree with employees versus employers? And what I mean by that is that it seems to me that when arbitration is imminent, both parties are going to try to state their own case, but they have to do it in a matter of fairness. And what the arbitrator has got to look at is how fair the offer being made really is. And I think that arbitrators do see through it when an offer being made is really not necessarily in good faith, but just trying to display one side of the issue and not really recognize what the other side of the issue is. I will support this bill. I think that there are, and I would agree with my colleague from Pendleton, I think that there are cases, other public workers that we maybe should prohibit from striking as well, but the present case is with the parole and probation officers, and I would agree that they should not be allowed to strike. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. With that, I'm going to go ahead and make the motion that we move House Bill 2576 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and would ask that Ann call the roll.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Crummell?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Excused.
Representative Pozanski?
Aye.
Representative Shetterly?
Excused.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Nay.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Excused.
Chair Williams?
Aye. House Bill 2576 will move to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I'll ask Representative Barker, with his experience, if he'd be willing to carry the bill on the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd love to do that.
And thank you, committee, for sticking through this longer meeting today. For all that hard work, I'm giving you tomorrow off. We're adjourned.
And lunch. And you're giving us lunch.